If the most noble tape engineers could start the tape and state the name of the session for the sake of them. I'm Marvin Landsverk, and the title of today's session is In Which God's Image, Men's or Women's? And I was trying to think, I don't even know any good feminist jokes. And I'll try this one. This isn't a feminist joke, and I think I could get... Well, we'll see. There's two people riding on a train. Man, there's this woman in a car by herself. Man walks in, they sit down. It's getting to be evening, and they're the only two. So it starts to get dark, and they start to get ready to lean the seats back and go to sleep. And the woman looks over at the man and bats her eyes at him. And he looks at her and bats his eyes at her. And then she leans over and says, "Would you get me a pillow?" Blink, blink. And he looks at her, and noticing her youth and beauty, he says, "Are you married?" And she says, "No." He says, "Would you like to pretend that you were?" She says, "Yes." He says, "Then go get your own pillow." That's not exactly, I think it's a feminist reaction joke, but... What I'd like to talk about today is, as the title says, in which God's image, men's or women's, and the issue is there a difference between the imaging of God, between the way men image God and women image God? And there's a number of ways to think about that, and I think all of them are extremely problematic. But I think it's still an important question. Another way of asking that question is to say something like, whose myths are these? Are these men's myths? Are they women's myths? And that's not the exact same question, but I think that's related. And that's really, I think, part of the way I'd like to address the issue today. And jumping off from some of the things we were talking about yesterday, most of the ancient mythologies that we've got that are saved come from patriarchal cultures where males have the power. And so they're in control of the societal organizations from which these myths emerge. Or, again, there's patriarchal control of social organizations, the myths produced by these cultures and then that produce those cultures have males in control, which, again, leading to the question, whose myths are these? Well, the myths themselves are coming from patriarchal cultures. Does that mean they're going to create extreme difficulty for women trying to get meaning from those? Some difficulty, or how are we to think about that? And I don't want to spend the whole time talking today, but let me just stop right now and just ask that question to you. Do you think there is a difference between the way men and women image God, between the way you image God?
Well, I think there's a difference. Maybe it's not female or male, but I think each person is unique and live in their own experiences, and so I think every person images God differently. Mm-hmm. And the fact that they're female probably plays a big role in how they image, because a female experiences things differently because of their nature. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
So the sort of mythic experience is individual and personal, and if it's individual, women are going to experience it differently, obviously.
Well, I think that we all know that people who see something come up with a different interpretation, so why is it not the same for us to, well, our experiences or our impressions of what God is like would be, they have to be centered in yourself.
Anybody else have a reaction, comment?
Well, I think that most of us grew up in an environment, if you went to, you know, Presbyterian or Lutheran or Methodist church, where the image of God was a male figure like a big dad,
mm-hmm.
who knew everything and told you so and whatever. That's the way it was for me. And so it's not until you become an adult that you realize, you know, as a woman, that, well, there's something wrong with that image. How come there's no female in this image? We have Jesus, we have God, a male, and then we have the Holy Spirit, whatever that might be, asexual, non-gender. So, you know, I think that for a lot of women, at least in my church, and for myself, our image of God has changed in the last 10 years, or whatever, since we've been adults.
To include other imagery and to reject.
To think of God as more of a parent figure or as having what would traditionally be called feminine traits, nurturing traits, as well as the, sort of what we think of as masculine, male traits.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You got a hand up?
We were just having this discussion. Yeah. Because I've worked with small children quite a bit. And I was just saying, in teaching Sunday school when I was 15 years old, God at that time was a male who was a disciplinarian. And now it's kind of worked through to where God is a nurturer and a loving nurturer. I mean, you know, it's changed and it's very generational. But the only way that I would know how a man views God is if a man tells me how he views God. Mm-hmm. I can't hope to speak for a man, nor could I speak for every woman,
mm-hmm.
as to how I perceive God.
Yeah, I think that's one of the problematic things about discussions like this. One of them is that, I mean, you've got sort of your experience, men have their experience, and it's hard to compare it yourself without experience. I mean, if only we could be Tiresias, you know, the Greek seer prophet who lived part of his life as a man and part of his life as a woman. And then, so he got to experience both and think both. And he was asked which was easier or which was more difficult. You remember his answer? He decided he liked being a woman better. He decided that was easier. And that's...
Skeptical story.
Oh yeah, it's a Greek myth from male culture.
Written by a man.
I think that the problem that I have at least is that even though the character of God has changed, I think, you know, like Judy said, you know, even taking the, you know, not having just that pure father image, but I still find my experience is that a lot of what is considered sacred to a woman is not included in a God image, and that trying to affirm that part of myself that is the feminine and associate with God is still at times a struggle, because I think a lot of the female aspects have been placed outside of God.
Yeah, and that's related to the other question I asked. And are these myths? Do these myths speak equally to men and women? And say even the
no.
Jesus story. How about the Jesus story? Does that mean a different thing to women than it does to men? The Jesus myth?
Well, I always jokingly say it couldn't be a Christian without Christ. I mean, Jesus brought in a lot of the female aspects to God. I mean, that's part of the transition was, you know, even though he was male in form, there was a lot of the female aspects of nurturing and things that we associate with the female aspect that were included in Christ. But I think it is a different experience.
Yeah, I think this problem gets so sticky so fast when you start to say, well, we associate certain things with feminine qualities, and even that starts to raise flags. If you start to say, well, this stuff is feminine, this stuff is masculine, and pretty soon, I mean, those are sort of culturally determined, or many aspects of the way we think about that. And the other level of problem, I think, here is just the level of language, the language we have to talk about these issues. So say social linguistics and language theorists that our language itself is controlled. The imagery, the origins, the concepts are masculine controlled, so that it's difficult for women to even express religious experience using a language that's other to them. And that gets a little bit removed from the issue, and yet I think it has to be connected. Yeah, John.
Well, Well, I would agree that it does really limit the experience of women, because look at the hero's adventure and mm-hmm. this discussion of that Campbell has. 95% of it is it's the male going out on his vision quest, or it's the male going through the initiation rite to become an adult. And I know that in some cultures there is an initiation rite for women, especially in North American Indian, mm-hmm. but that's pretty well neglected by Campbell, I think, and it's a lot of emphasis. And where does that leave the woman and her quest for finding her true identity or her bliss? I found that lacking in Campbell's series.
And that's, I mean, we talked a little bit about this before, that, I mean, he makes a comment even that it's easier for women to find their identity than it is for men. That's why we have so many men hero myths, because it's harder for men. Women have to sit around in their huts, they have their period, and they know who they are.
And that's, what an idiot!
I think, in his defense, when he says that, he's making a descriptive statement. I don't think he's making a value. He's describing myths from the myths he said. It's patriarchal cultures, and that's the message of the myth. It's easier for men than women. I mean, and that's part of the message, whether it's true or not. I mean, obviously, I think it's not, but he's sort of describing that. And again, where does that lead? Where are you going to turn for spiritual message and reward if the bulk of the mythology is coming from with messages like that? Yeah.
I'd like to sort of raise a different kind of issue. I've noticed in our church and in many other churches that the church population, despite mm-hmm. the history of patriarchy, mm-hmm. is mostly women.
Yeah.
So the church seems to work or not work, whichever it is that we're saying it does, more for women than it does for men. And if you look at the kinds of qualities that are supported by traditional Christian values, that they're often or the kinds that aren't. Okay, where do you get a message that being a car mechanic or pilot of an airplane, those kinds of skills and delights, are those values? Is that kind of practical rationality still spiritual or not? Why is it that our church is now 60-40 or something, and mm-hmm. most churches have?
Yeah, that adds another layer of complexity to this, and a layer I think that I don't want, so please leave, David. Yeah.
In commenting to that, I have, in my lifetime, heard men say, my wife takes care of that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that is giving that a giving religion, I don't know how to put this, sort of, well, this is a feminine thing to do, mm-hmm. that I go out and I earn a living and my wife takes care of that. And I've heard men say that.
Yeah.
I don't go to church. Well, I'm a different generation. I don't go to church because my wife takes care of that. Now, I'm not saying, that I'm not saying that is a masculine trait and all men say that. But I've heard that. So, hence, maybe there is some view that religion is the feminine thing. Which I totally disagree with, and I certainly don't hear a lot of that anymore, but I used to hear that.
Yeah, and even in that comment, that's women, they can do their little thing over there, manly men, and they don't need that. So even that, in that sort of expression, sort of devalues it a little bit, if someone else can take care of it, serve its function.
But if her husband said, or the man,
by the way,
said, you take care of it, and the wife took the kids to a coven meeting, you can bet he would take control of that. Mm-hmm.
To a what?
I mean, it's like,
so witches, or?
To a female religion, an explicitly female oriented, mm-hmm. then that would be different. I think it's sort of the ultimate in our slavery, then we do the bidding, Sure, we'll go take the kids and indoctrinate them into a patriarchal religion. We'll do that for you. I mean, that's sort of.
So, there's a number of different things. I mean, when you talk about sort of an individual in a church, many of them are women. Women run the church, and then the sort of the nurturing and spiritual rewards you get out of that. You're saying at times that if you're male in a church, you feel left out. And yet, sort of looking back over messages of the myth and the histories, I mean, the messages of the males, or certainly in the power control.
They're already gods. Sort of, they don't need to go to church.
Well, I would like to take issue with that. My family worked this way. I mean, my family origin worked this way. My father did not go to church. My mother did. My mother brought us. My father said, you know, okay, this is your function. You take them. He also really did not like the church that she took us to. But I think there was a kind of sense in his mind also that this was something he was sort of tone deaf to. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like he. Neighbor said, "I'm spiritually unmusical." I think there is a kind of sense. Also, I mean, what you're describing may well be real. I think there is also a sense among men that this is a domain that we're not good at.
To be
in that you take care of it may also mean this is, you know about this.
We're not comfortable. Yeah. As comfortable.
Yeah. I think now you're talking about maybe just a cultural thing.
Well, sure, I am talking.
There's a certain generation, older generation of men that don't sing. You know, if you look around the service, a lot of 60-year-old men will just stand there and hold the book, you know, because they don't sing. They follow the words, they read the words, but for some reason they got the idea that it wasn't really a manly thing to sing. And I mean, and that's just a small piece in time or whatever. I mean, that's just, you know, the way that was just their culture. Whereas, you know, the way I was raised, my father took us to church and my father was always in the choir, and my father was always on church council and stuff like that. And for me, very, you know, big part of my, you know, the male identity is to be active in the church. So, you know, it's different for different people.
Is that because you're a role model?
But how does that all tie in with the image of God
that
we're talking about?
Well, image of God and myth. I guess the way I tie that into to myth is to talk about the four functions of myth again for a minute.
I
hate to break.
Did
anybody go?
Yeah.
I wish I was here.
It's on tape.
Is that, yeah. Again, four functions of myth. Mystical. I can't write, it's too small. Cosmological.
Sociological.
Pedagogical.
Yeah.
Sociological.
Pedagogical. Whatever. I get it. I mean, all myths have all four functions, and those things all overlap. Again, mystical, that's myth that connects God and you. That's sort of the mystical, radical union of us and it, or God and us. And the cosmological function, myth gives us some picture of the cosmos universe. Sociological, myth defines who we are in social institutions, and pedagogical teaches you about the other three. I think the mystical function of myth, that's the one that has the potential to be the most radical, and the potential to include sort of all kinds of different individual, since mysticism is individual, that's where you get sort of this blending of possibilities between men's and women's images of God and their stories. Possibility. Although Campbell, that's what he's most interested in, he talks about that in hero formula terms, and he turns that almost exclusively, I think, into male mysticism. And he doesn't address... He does, it limits him, but in the video series, especially, he doesn't address feminine mysticism very substantially. And I think that needs to be discussed in other ways than hero formulas, with other types of models. And we'll get back to a couple of these things. So that's one, I think, that needs to be pursued sort of for this discussion today for imaging God. The cosmological one, too, And there's cosmologies where the universe is God's body, that it's women's body, and it's men's body. I mean, that alone isn't going to tell you much, because it depends on who controls the body. And most of the myths, it's the men that control the body. And yet, I think it's interesting to look at myths from cultures where women are carving out control of the universe, and see what sort of messages that can give. The sociological function of myth, I think, is really getting into some of the things we're talking about here, or the sociological functioning of religion. That's the most conservative function of myth. That's defining who we are as opposed to who somebody else is. And it's that function of myth, I think, that deserves to be most heavily scrutinized by us looking at ancient myths and trying to examine what's the message of myth for us today. I think mystical messages translate across time. Sociological messages don't necessarily, because those reflect and define this particular culture they come from. Since most of the myths come from patriarchal cultures, that's part of their message, the baggage that comes along, that beware women's sexuality, beware women's power, and let's image God as male and make sure that male's in control. And I think that part of that is what creates then the problems. Well, how do you separate out these different functions when they all overlap? And I think it's almost impossible, almost, or maybe it is impossible, or maybe it's easier for some people than it is for others. But I think it helps to think about separating the two, or separating all of those out when you're approaching thinking about myth. One other thing that I'd say that sort of creates a problem for what we're even talking about here is Eliade says about myth that we can't determine what our myths are any more than we can determine what we're going to dream about tonight. You can't. No one here can think, I'm going to dream about something and then dream about it, because myths are like dreams. Myths are public dreams. Dreams are private myths. And Eliade says myth is not ideology. And in a sense, what we're talking about when we raise this issue of gender, we're talking about ideological questions. Now, does everybody agree with that? Myth is not ideology? Eliade says that. Would you agree? Does that make sense? That is, we can't sort of carve out what sort of vision of the world we want to have and then construct our myths to fit that certain, because myths aren't produced that way. Myths emerge. Myths are produced, I mean, if you're Jungian, from sort of the collective unconscious that just emerge. Now, myths will have ideological impact, all kinds of it, in their sociological function. But myth as a whole is not ideological. Interpretations of myth are, the story is the story that emerges from wherever. The interpretation of the story will be extremely ideological, and it will reflect our own biases, our own values, and our own cultural. And that's not to say those interpretations are bad or that we shouldn't, but I think it's useful to separate those two as well, the interpretation from the story. Yeah.
So then wouldn't it be true then the myths that we pay attention to, because we have this huge selection of myths to pay attention to, and then also, are we creating new myths today and that will express the collective unconsciousness?
Yeah, and that's...
We can either pick and choose old ones that have meaning to us today.
Right.
Or we can create new ones. Are we creating new ones?
Well, and that notion of creating, I think myths are always being created around us. Mm-hmm. And to intentionally say, well, let's sneak in some ones that we really like here and
but how
hope
are
they catch.
Which, what are they? What are the new ones?
That's a good question.
We have an American myth of the American businessman and who he is and the battles, struggles that he goes with. And here at Holden for the last couple of decades, we have attempted to create a myth that's small is beautiful. Now, we may not have bought into that, and the culture surely hasn't. But Holden has been busy, and so has a lot of our culture, trying to create a new myth that small is really beautiful, but we've not bought it.
And there, you can talk about there's some element of intention then in the creation of myth, and yet I think there's intention behind what Holden's up to, but the myths that get created here, no one sits down to write, and it really, and it a myth is a story, and people go out and tell the story of Holden, and if that spreads and starts to function in society in different ways, then you've got myth.
Well, is that an expression of the poverty of our society, though? I mean, in a sense, we have a poverty of spirituality, or
right.
we have up until a certain point, and those stories aren't being written, but is that because, you know, why is that? I mean, I have to question why most of our stories come out of the past. And that not very many have written.
Yeah, one response to that, I think most of, and Campbell says something like this too, but most myths being created today are sociological. They're not mystical. And so there's very little sort of room for the engines of mysticism and spirituality to generate myths because there's no ear for them. So even if they are being produced anyplace, they're disappearing into the ether. Well, the sociological myths are what continue to fascinate us. I mean, in feminist discussions, you get down to arguing ideology and social structures and organizations very quickly. And I think what produces lots of our sociological myths certainly are just, I mean, business, capitalism, market economies, industrialization that sort of drives our myths. And where are our myths coming from now? You know, if I ask that question in my classes, at MSU, people answer MTV and laugh, but in a sense, that's somewhat true. MTV is producing myths, and television is the source for our mythology today. And I think maybe the most pernicious source is advertising. Yeah?
As far as the, you know, I've said this before, I believe that myths are inert, constantly being produced by necessity, and I think that, you know, there's the whole thing about the archetypal and what our basic psychologies are and all this, but it seems like the ancient myths, whether they sprang from the from the collective unconscious or what, but they explain what couldn't be explained, mm-hmm. right? And it seems to me like these huge, huge markers in our history, like the possibility of nuclear warfare, or venturing into outer space, that those that alone will somewhere are changing our consciousness, and that the myths will come out of that. New myths, new ways, another boundary, another frontier, another explanation of what lies beyond.
You can argue who gets to go first.
You or me. you know, I was thinking that in terms of creating myths today, what about somebody like President Bush, who in the race with Dukakis, the Willie Horton stuff? I mean, there was some lies, I perceive. And so, I mean, is there a myth there? Would you call that a myth? Or what about the story about the drug bust that was faked right across the street from the White House? You know, how do those kinds of things affect us?
I think that's just lying.
That's
just lying. But I see it. I think since the late 60s, you know, when, you know, with, I think there was a movement for an alternative culture. And, you know, with the generation really rejecting everything that went before it. And I was just in Portland for the last year. And I see people creating churches and communities and living in another world of myth. There's a couple of newspapers called Talking Leaves and things that are just collections from around the world of different myths, and people are forming new ways of looking at things. Mm-hmm. And it's not an ideology in the sense of, you know, how I'd use that word at all. They're not trying to push something. They're going inward, I think. And I think there's big movements that way.
Yeah, I think there's sort of the most powerful. I mean, my interpretation, negative myth, it would be the ones generated from advertising, which, I mean, the message of that myth is completely different from the message of most ancient myths, and that's. As Campbell says, the message of myth is, you're it. or translate that you and the other are one. The religions, mythologies, it's part of the mystical function, meaning of myth, that you and another person are one, and that you're it, and also subsidiary message is that life is suffering. And sort of our modern myth is that you are it, taken to an extreme, forgetting that you and the other are one. So just the you are it is what beer ads, dancing beer cans, and saying that you can have it all is the message of our modern mythology. You can have it all, buy it or steal it. And no longer do you need to suffer, and that suffer like the gods suffer to live. And I think sort of that seems to me that one of our dominant myths, which may be changing, and I think as you're talking about sort of these grassroots mythologies that are coming about, and I think environmentalism, and I don't know how to label it in any other sort of way, but creation awareness environmentalism is driving into all kinds of different places, far beyond Sierra Club, that I think is, I mean, again, in my values, a beneficial myth, and that has ties to all kinds of old myths too that it's drawing upon. And I guess that's what I'd like to sort of get back into and look at some myths from the past, and maybe get back to this question of imaging God and men versus women too, to sort of ask, where are we to go, especially for a woman, where's a woman to go to find myths that are hers? And there's a number of maneuvers you can make, and one is a maneuver that Eliada, sort of guru of myth analysis from 60s on, talks about, and that's to emphasize the fact that in ancient mythologies, myths have inherent in them balance. And he's specifically looking at sort of mystical and cosmological functions of myth, not sociological. But in sort of the mystical messages of myth, there is this principle that he calls, that you got Latin in the play last night, and he likes to label all his ideas Latin so that everyone will be impressed, I think. But the coincidentia oppositorum. Got that? And that's at the root of mythology, you can think about it, is separation, dualism of opposites that myth brings together. And that's sort of the mystical union. But the way that it gets expressed in lots of mythologies is, so one god, two faces. The two-faced God that are opposites. So God is both death and creation. And at the heart of mythic symbolism, so says Eliada, you've constantly got that symbolism being played out. So creation, destruction, being two aspects of the same force. The solar, the serpentine. In Greek mythology, Zeus is both this moral lawgiver, and he's also this philanderer. He's the god that holds together the kin group, but he's the god that's always running around breaking up kin groups too. And Eliade says that sort of a central structure of divinity is that principle, this union of opposites. And as he says, this is a quote, "Myth reveals more profoundly than any rational experience could the actual structure of divinity, which transcends all attributes and reconciles all contraries." That's mystical functioning of myth. And he even says, even in such a structured a tradition as Judeo-Christian religion, you get that those same principles sort of coming through. So Yahweh is both kind and wrathful. And Christian mythology, God remains gentle, nurturing, and terrible, both. So you see it in Judeo-Christian traditions too, but often in what are so-called primitive mythologies, you see it very clearly symbolically. So again, Eliade will emphasize that sort of one aspect of this is this myth of divine androgyny. This God, as the union of opposites, is also the union of male and female. So that many myths have deities or a important deity that's androgynous. It's both male and female. So it's a god that's a hermaphrodite. It'll have some male characteristics and some female characteristics. Or that there's the god's sexuality is both. So it's bisexual deities. And a lot of the Greek deities, and not just Greek deities, are bisexual. Dionysus is the sexuality of Dionysus is bisexual. Adonis is too, and in Indian mythology, there, you know a lot more about this than I do, but I guess there are certain couples in Indian mythology, like the Shiva and Kali, two separate deities, but often are portrayed as a married couple, or they're together. In fact, are treated as one single unit, the male and female principle together as one.
So there's one kind of sculpture that shows them split vertically down the center of their body. And one side is male and the other side.
Yeah. So split sideways or somehow. And that's Egypt, Greek, Iranian. Most religious mythic traditions have this notion of an androgynous god. God that is both male and female. Which elements of that split get carried into the Judeo-Christian tradition, although sort of the female aspects of God get subdued, although certainly now people are going back and saying, let's find those female attributes. Also then in the mythology, that's carried over into humans then, so you get myths of human androgyny. And you can even think of the creation stories we were looking at yesterday. Genesis 1, God splits into Adam and Eve. There's God as androgynous male-female splitting into Adam and Eve, male-female. So there's sort of that notion retained there. And in Genesis 2, God creates Adam, and here's the human androgyne. Adam splits into male and female. So the notion of Adam and Eve being sort of this androgynous pair before the creation, and I think maybe that's one reason why Hebrew tradition saves both. There's a similar message there. Especially if you're not thinking sociologically, like we were talking about those yesterday, but sort of the mystic point. And I think thinking about gods in those types of terms, I don't know if it does that help or not. Is that one response to say, okay, we've got myths, stories, images of God that come from patriarchal traditions, and yet in their deep symbolism, it's male and female? And I think taking that emphasis, and especially in traditions that sort of devalue the feminine sides of gods, to revalue them and find them, is that beneficial? Is that a maneuver
yes.
that can make religion more significant? Yeah. Is that enough, I guess?
No. I think the important thing is to remember that over a period of time, this was lost. And that's what Christ brought it back when he said there is no male or female, we are all one.
Yeah.
And to return to what it was originally meant to be understood as.
Yeah, so that line, in Paul says, in Christ there is no male, female, no east nor west. What's the rest of that?
Jew nor Greek.
Yeah, Jew nor Greek.
No slave nor free.
And that's the great mythic, mystical union, and that's part of Jesus' message. So that's Jesus as androgynous, even, or the union of all. Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, but Jesus did pray to a male when he said, Our Father.
Yeah.
So that Abba. Was his concept, but then he was, you know, as human, he was product of the culture, too.
Yeah. And this begins to raise all those sticky questions about which are you going to say, okay, these are the ones we want to value, the mystical fundamental messages of the myth of the tradition, and which are sociological, which we can just leave out.
Yeah.
We did, was having this discussion yesterday. Does that mean any gender hierarchies that you find in our tradition therefore are just limited to the time, leave them out? Or did God intend it that way? Is that why Jesus came then? To that particular culture. Any comments about that? Yeah.
Well, this is going back a step, but it's fine for us to talk about what we can do personally, but the Lutheran Church has no interest at all in looking back at the feminine. Mm-hmm. The bishops of the church recently came out and said that inclusive language cannot be used in sacraments.
Did they really?
Yeah.
I go to Methodist church, so I'm out of the loop here for Lutherans.
Yeah, so apparently if you do a baptism, baptism and don't say Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, it doesn't take.
Really?
Oh, you should become a
We could proselytize for all kinds of traditions. How about we could worship Zeus or something too?
Well, it's interesting just who that group is and how that's going to change in 20 years.
Well, they're the powerful people of our church who tell us in what form we can worship in public. We can do anything we want in private,
sure.
But you know, I can't do anything I want in public, and I have it spoon-fed to me what my image of God is in public is told to me.
Hmm. Yeah. That I hadn't heard that. And that all of, in the last 10-15 years, there's been this whole movement in even Lutheran churches to reclaim feminine imagery of the Bible. And I think one of the themes a few years ago up here, in the shadow of God's wings. I mean, that's sort of feminine imagery, and I think that's from a psalm, isn't it?
But Jesus said, you know, O Jerusalem, that I were a hen gathering my chicks under my wings.
So there's some there, and in spite of the very, especially of Hebrew, patriarchal, sociological organizations. But I guess, I mean, that's interesting to me, is to see that sort of mythic union of male and female in lots of the traditions that is helpful to try to follow up on. Yeah.
There's a real helpful thing that came out several years ago, Inclusive Language from ELCA.
Mm-hmm.
And it's talking about in the Bible, there's like 147 different words for God. So you can have these Lutheran theologians like Karl Broughton say that Father, Son, Holy Spirit is the proper name of God. But yet before Father, Son, and Holy Spirit was the proper name of God, there were 140 other names. Mm-hmm. But still, you know, it goes on. You know, we just have the New Revised Standard Version. And when they go back and translate a passage, they'll stick kind of with what it already was. Like in the Old Testament, it'll say in the Hebrew that God's womb quivered.
Mm-hmm.
And then that is translated as God's heart was moved with mercy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? You know, because we can't handle that, you know? Because when King James translated that, you know, that would be obscene to say that God's womb quivered. It was not done.
It translated idiomatically, and right. Our idiom for that, or 17th century idiom, was heart quivers rather than. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So this is still being done. You know, our best biblical scholarship still cannot say that.
Hmm. I think all that movement with language and thinking and imaging God, I think, I mean, that's one move. I think it's exceedingly important. Another one is this whole goddess reclamation movement that's going on. And that's to go back, not just in Judeo-Christian tradition, but other myths from patriarchal cultures where goddess imagery has been sort of taken control too, and focus on powerful goddess images in other traditions. And that's, and there's lots of stories, I mean, like this book, Ancient Mirrors of Womanhood, that collects myths from lots of different traditions that are about goddesses. And it's an interesting story because sort of the principle of selection here, it's very ideological. It's, let's pick goddess myths where gods are made powerful. And yet still reading this, it makes you wonder, because lots of the stories, the goddesses are still under control of men, and yet they're carving out their own realm and territory. And I'd like to get maybe read one of these that's in here in a minute, but talk about sort of another move also that's being attempted, and that's trying to get back before the patriarchy. And that's to get to myths and see what myths from a culture before patriarchy existed, and if myths are sort of this product of true spiritual insight, to see before some of the sociological pollution came in. And that's where things get extremely problematic, because there's so many arguments about whether that's possible or what, or if there ever were matriarchal cultures that existed before patriarchy. And sort of that pattern I sketched out yesterday, early agriculture has matriarchal cultures, or at least women with some power, lots of scholars will agree with. Sort of the details of what's going on there is very difficult. But you get anthropologists and archaeologists looking back there to see, okay, well, what can we find about the myths and religions of those times? Yeah.
A book that would describe that very well is When God Was a Woman by Merlin Stone.
Yeah, that's same author as that.
Yeah, she is an archaeologist who looked at these kind of matriarchal patterns, and that was the way it was before. And just a comment about what I'm hearing. It's frustrating to make it seem so easy, you know, to say that we have, as women and as men in the church, have accepted male images of God, and not to say that we have accepted them, but to say that we need to reclaim the feminine, and that that can easily go together. I know my own experience is, then what do I do with the masculine images that aren't right for me, that shame me, and stuff like that? That's hard just to say that, well, once we can reclaim the feminine, you know, mysticism is going to put it together, and it's going to be great.
Right.
I think a lot of women, and all I can say is myself, do carry that around.
Right.
And that's just something to think of.
Yeah, that's a good point. And that's not even my term. Goddess reclamation, that sounds like something would go on at a dump too, and sort of dig around at a dump and reclaim the land. And yet, so I mean, there's that part, and then what do you do with the rest? You need to have some sort of...
Yeah, it doesn't fit from my experience, that I can't be destructive or, you know,
demeaning. So some research done into early, quote, matriarchal societies, I think it's interesting, and let me just describe this one briefly. To see if sort of trying to do that is another useful move. And I think ideologically, politically, all these moves are useful. Spiritually, that's another question, whether individually it does you personally any good. But Ann Barstow has done some work into particular place in Turkey, Anatolia, and early cultures there from about 6,000 BC, so when God was a woman there. But the difficulty with sort of finding the myths is they didn't have written language, so none of the written myths survive. And you get Anatolian myths later, from later cultures, that have connections, but you don't have any way to find the myths. We don't have their stories. All we've got are archaeological evidence and then people speculating and inventing interpretations, stories. But here's an interpretation of archaeological evidence of that area and of early prehistoric goddess figures. And that's typically they're presented as goddesses of childbirth. You'd expect that. Also, some of their other attributes, sources of wisdom, of healing, called the Lady of Beasts, of prophecy, and also associated with death. Preeminently, though, fertility is the function in childbirth and crops and animals, humans as well. And so she's referred to as Great Mother, Earth Mother. So again, source of all creativity. And again, what most of the speculation is based on is these little figurines they dig up. And they're women, and they don't have faces, not just because I think they've been worn off, and they said they didn't have faces. And they don't have legs. So it's as if they sort of rise out of the earth, and this sort of every woman figure, without an individualizing face, she can stand for everybody. Often naked, big-breasted, sometimes actually giving birth, big-bodied mesomorphs, big buttocks, and sort of this Rubenesque figure, just so the amplitude and ampleness of the feminine body. And sometimes nursing a figure, which gets carried into the patriarchal religions, icons, with Mary holding Jesus, the Pietas, is the same mythic image from way back, or Isis in Egyptian religion with Horus at her breast. Anne Barstow asks, okay, what could the religion of this period have been like, and particularly this Anatolian site that they've been doing some digging at? And it's impossible to say, again, speculation, but you can speculate about what the values, what the organizations would have been, where it seems that women did have power, and that seems to be the case. Whether it's a matriarchal society or not, no one knows. I mean, again, some scholars will say that it just is an appearance of feminine power, just because they have a little votive symbols of the feminine, doesn't mean that that's a feminine society. Maybe men were making those images as more objectification of a female body. Maybe. But it's a particular site at Ketal Hayuk, which my pronunciation there is terrible, but it's an urban center of Anatolia, which from the archaeology, not from the myth, they can see a couple things. The town is organized like a beehive, and it lasted 1,000 years, and so a long time. It was economically powerful, they can tell, but the interesting thing is there's shrines all over the place, more shrines per square mile than many cultures. And it seemed to be every family group had its own shrine, and from the paintings on the wall is where the information comes from. Paintings on the wall of significant religious objects, often women's breasts with a child's handprint on it shows up. And they found no places for sacrifice, for burnt sacrifices or a blood sacrifice either. So Barstow's speculation and an interpretation on what they see is that on the earliest shrines, it seemed to have been a hunting culture, and there's no goddesses. In about 6,200 BC, the goddess shows up on the wall. And the goddess is depicted as, in the first expression, with her legs spread apart, giving birth. And underneath, I guess this is a fantastic image, with this row of breasts underneath the painting of the woman, and out of the nipple of the breast are coming these sort of animal skulls, jaws, and monster figures.
Weird.
And conclusion there is already, with the first appearance of the goddess, you've got Eliade's duality of goddess of life and death being together at the same time. So it's the goddess of fertility, goddess of death, the same thing, and again, that Eliade says all mythic systems will have, and then there it is in her. She's also, her statues are found in all their grain bins, and so she's obviously the goddess of fertility for agriculture. Sometimes she's pregnant, sometimes she's just dancing around not married, but, and then other images of her have a vulture perched on her. So bird of death, again, she's the goddess of all life and death. And male statues are very rare. They don't find them. What they find are male fertility symbols, some bulls, but not human body. The last period of this 1,000-year run of this particular culture, the mural, they found a mural which was earlier painted with a hunting scene. It got painted over and then destroyed and a new shrine built to the goddess. So about the 58th century BC, conclusions are that this is a very much goddess-oriented society, focused on God and goddess as the, sort of this even androgynous figure, sort of uniting of opposites. Now, we don't have the stories from that culture, but we've got sort of the depictions of that goddess imagery. And Barstow is asking the questions. In many of the major religions today, there's not enough for women's spirituality. Is their message, use, some help in sort of this ancient stuff that they're digging up? And her conclusion for her is, yeah, but still that's not enough. Because the primary imagery of the feminine spirit still there is fertility. And that sort of for modern culture, women's spirituality and mythology needs more than fertility. So, again, I think sort of three ways of doing mythical archaeology, but and we started discussing this in the middle. What next? I mean, where are we to go? What types of directions would be helpful for the church? And how are we to go about producing or trying to influence new myths? I think that ends up being the big question, because I think part of what you see from this whole history of sort of the patriarchal myths is how easily it incorporates the images of the feminine, and in spite of David, or in spite of images of feminine power, still putting those images of feminine power under the control of yeah. that remains a question. Any other comments?
I was just going to say, when you say something about the what can the churches do, I think one of the fine things that they have opened up, allowing the clergy, especially in the Methodist church, to include both sexes, and some of the women clergy people are doing an excellent job in every aspect, intellectually, the sermons, the pastoring of the flock and everything. So maybe this is just the beginning of a change in which the young people coming up will identify their spirituality in the feminine role more.
Yeah, it's got to help, I think. And
well, the women are doing a great job, I feel.
And the other movement, you're talking about androgynes and bisexual gods to allow homosexuals full participation in the church and in the pulpit, which, again, gets even stickier in a lot of people's traditions. Although, I mean, I guess my ideology would see that also as beneficial. But that's me. Yeah.
Well, no, in the persona of the triune God, I've been told that the Greek for the Holy Spirit was feminine.
Greek for spirit, yeah.
I don't know but it's a feminine term.
Right, spirit, breath, associated with feminine term.
You know more about that than I, but I'm just thinking maybe they just decided to incorporate the feminine with the masculine, because we have, in Judeo-Christian, we always think of God as we say, God the Father, you know, Christ the Son, and the Holy Spirit.
Right.
Maybe to balance it, they decided to have the Holy Spirit be feminine.
Yeah, and there's people here probably that know more about the history of the discussions of the Trinity than I do.
Well, that's all I know.
Yeah.
I just want to say, from a practical standpoint, what churches do is not to go berserk and allow the women to get together and to look into all this, and it's going to be looking into paganism and what's called that, and to really study without harassment, and bring so that they can bring the imagery back and integrate it. I happen to think that I think that the image of Christ can reconcile this stuff in some way. And the other thing to do, you know, if you want to go a little bit further, is to read and study intensely and get in touch with oneself. And I just want to make a comment about Thelma and Louise again, you know, because they were on the land from the patriarchy, and they sort of went through different stages of shedding it, acting out, blah, 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 blah. But I don't want to destroy the film for people who haven't seen it, but I also want to entice you to see it, because in the end, there's this wonderful line about will be...
you know the movie she's talking about, Thelma and Louise? Yeah.
Drinking margaritas in the sun, Mamacita, Mama, Margarita. And then, you know, they're on the land trying to get to Mexico, and they end up, well, let's say they end up in the Grand Canyon area, which is, in the Hopi tradition, is the slip, the female that we all came out of, and this is where they now dwell. I mean, that's, to me, is... There's a wonderful part in that film where they stand out in the dawn, alone, in the desert wilderness, and they're out of the patriarchy.
With the Earth Mother. I think we're officially out of time, so I'd like to thank you all for coming. Again, if you have more comments, questions, let's sit around, but let's officially end for the tape's sake.